and we're joined now live on the telephone by Andrew Skirka. And Andrew is a distinguished adventurer. He's an athlete, speaker, guide, writer, probably best known for his solo long-distance trips, such as one that he just completed here last September, the Alaska Yukon Expedition. He's also won Adventure of the Year from the National Geographic Society and Person of the Year by Backpacker Magazine. So, Andrew, I really want to thank you for joining us here tonight.
Hey, thanks for having me on the program.
You bet. You know, at 29 years old, I was taking a look at all of the miles that you put under your belt in the Arctic and other places, and I guess starting out with the Appalachian Trail a few years ago, but you've covered a lot of ground in a short time. Very impressive.
It has been a lot of miles, and there's part of me that's a little bit concerned about that because I'm probably an early candidate for hip replacement and knee replacement. But frankly, you know, humans are supposed to walk. So I think that there's, and I've been doing it. My biomechanics are good, and I haven't been injured while I've been walking. So I'm hoping that I'm just building up a lot of strength and not necessarily wearing through anything.
You know, my first thought when I saw your age at 29 and also what you've accomplished is when I was in my 20s, and I think most people in their 20s, you know, the biggest thing around you are your friends and socializing. But there you are out spending a great portion of your life on solo treks in the wilderness. How does that work for you? How do you balance that out?
Well, the balance is actually a lot healthier than it might seem. I probably, on average, only spend somewhere between a third and a half of the year out. And it varies year to year. Like last year, I was probably out for about 7 or 8 months. But the year before that, was probably only 3 or 4. So in between, I'm usually always coming back to Boulder, Colorado, and I have great friends here, and they've gotten kind of accustomed to saying goodbye for a month or two, or sometimes 6 or 7, and then I come back. And in fact, one of my very good friends calls me her best part time friend.
Well, I know it.
Go
ahead, Andrew.
I was gonna, just the balance is healthier than mm-hmm. than it looks, and even though I spend so much time in the wilderness, I'm not the hermit that most people would suspect. In fact, usually when the people hear my bio, they anticipate me being some sort of Grizzly Adams. But then they meet me and they're like, wait a minute, this guy is like clean cut, all American kid. It looks like, you know, my neighbor's son. So they're always usually a little surprised with the difference between the bio and who I am in reality.
Well, I don't think I was balanced at all, because I couldn't have been out for more than 2 weeks when I was your age. I'd be missing the girls and the social life. Kind of consume me at that time. So I think it's just great that you have the maturity to live the life you do. You've also been able to translate your adventures into and your lifestyle into an occupation. Can you tell us just how that works and how it's evolved for you?
Sure. So I've been really fortunate in that respect. I never got into adventuring because I thought I could make a livelihood out of it. It's still not the primary motivation today. There are a lot easier ways to make money and a lot easier ways to make more money than what I do now. But between the trips themselves, and then I'm also able to do a lot of public speaking and guiding and writing, and it also helps that I'm actually now 30 years old, and I've kind of been doing this ever since I graduated college, so I've never lost that college frugality. So they're always two sides of the equation. There's your income, and then there are your expenses. And if you keep your expenses really low, you don't need a whole lot of income to sustain your existence. And that's kind of been my philosophy on things. So, I couldn't be happier with my job.
Yeah, it sure sounds like it. You know, a lot of adventurers today doing expeditions. Those expeditions end up being tied to causes such as global warming and other causes in the wilderness. What are some of your motivations, and what do you bring back to people?
I think it's important, or it was important on the Alaska Yukon expedition, just to kind of call a spade a spade. I was drawn to the last trip, and that matter, not just the Alaska trip, but other trips that I'd done before for the experience that I thought those trips would provide me. I have this faith that if I put myself out of my comfort zone and take on some risk and do something different, that something really good will come out of it. And I think that alone is a justifiable reason to do a trip like this. You don't need to necessarily raise attention to climate change or to energy development or for, you know, AIDS research, and all those causes are important, but I don't think that a trip like this is a good vehicle to talk about those issues. I think if you were really genuine about raising awareness of some of these issues, that you would donate your time or donate a lot of money or take on a job with an organization like that, instead of trying to turn one of these trips into something that it's really not.
Mm-hmm. And your motivations, from what I'm hearing, are so much like earlier explorers, to get out there and experience what it is to be in the wilderness.
Yeah, it's more of a classical quest for adventure in that sense. You bet. You bet. Mm-hmm.
Now, how do you decide? Your last expedition was across much of Alaska and into the Yukon. How do you decide where you really want to go? I mean, it's a big world out there, and you've had so many adventures. That, as I look over the resume, you know, the Great Western Loop and the Sierra High Route and places where there probably is an existing trail. But what's your process?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think my focus has been, or the trips end up being, again, sort of an experience that I want to have. And I have a kind of like a been there, done that attitude. And part of the reason for me going on these trips is for the sort of that educational value in terms of learning new skills and being in different places. And I find that it's important, at least to me, to switch things up. And to my trips have also become sort of progressively more difficult, more like logistically more difficult, a little bit more committing. So if you look at the evolution, I started, you know, pretty humbly with a thru-hike of the Appalachian Trail in 2002, and there's like 1,500 to 2,000 people who start the Appalachian Trail every spring. So I was, you know, one of 1,500, say, and then over the years, the trips have kind of just gotten bigger and bigger. I've continued to up the ante, so I went to the American West, and I hiked across North America and spent the winter up in the North Country, and then I went to Alaska last year. So I think that for me, it's sort of that I need to keep on getting out of my comfort zone for a trip to be worthwhile, and so the trips are always someplace that I haven't done and involving some activities that I've never done, and maybe a little bit faster and a little bit further than I've done before.
Do you have as you mentioned, you know, you've been a great variety in the places you've gone, but do you have a favorite trail system, a favorite place that really has put you where you wanted to be?
I think that's kind of like asking which child you love most.
Okay.
I think all of my experiences worked for me at the time. I would never do the Appalachian Trail again. I would never do the C2C route again. I would never do the Great Western Loop again. All those experiences were sort of suit me for where I was in my adventuring career, but they're not really where I am now. And even the Alaska trip, it was awesome. There are parts that I would highly recommend for other people to do. There are probably a couple of parts that I'll get back to and do again, but nothing on that grand scale.
Now, we should tell people that are having a picture of what you do, that you're also a great athlete, and you're not just a guy out there with oversized boots just tromping through the through the brush. You actually did the Leadville 100, which is one of the best known ultra marathon races in the United States, and not only did you do it, but you came in second your first time out.
That's right. I definitely have. I come from a background of an athlete. I ran Division I cross country and track, and I was an all state runner in high school. So for me to challenge myself physically as a way to sort of get at myself mentally is a big draw for me to do these trips. Mm-hmm. And because of that athletic background, I'm able to do some trips that are physically and mentally more intense than other people might want to or can. So like the Great Western Loop is a perfect example where on that trip, it was a 6,875 mile trip around the American West. And I averaged 33 miles a day for 208 days. And I only took 8 days off, five of which for a funeral. And if you take those days out, I think I averaged something like almost 36 miles a day.
Wow.
And I look back at that, and that's like a real demonstration of athletic prowess. And obviously the mental piece is there. But that's part of the draw of these trips.
Well, another part of traveling that rapidly, you know, being able to move smoothly like that has to be the gear that you use and even cutting down the weight to travel that many miles a day and as rapidly as you're able to go. Have you kind of made that a science for yourself?
Yeah, it has kind of become a science. I'm also extremely analytical, so I get really into the not just the weight of gear, but its performance and its durability and its, and its technology. So when I look at a piece of gear, I put it on a spreadsheet and I compare it to other potential products, and the system that I come out with at the end is the whole gear system is the one that has the highest performance for the least amount of weight that has the durability that I and for the at this point, like average three season conditions. So if I were to do a trip up in Minnesota during, say, August, I'd probably be out there with a pack that weighed 7 or 8 pounds minus food and water. And then I usually recommend carrying about a pound and a half of food per day. And I probably wouldn't need to carry very much water because there's a lot of water in Minnesota. So in my pack probably would never be more than 15 pounds for a 4 or 5 day trip.
Yeah, not only does your gear have to be right, but actually you really have to have kind of a minimalist mind, too, so you're not taking a lot of frivolous things to occupy yourself.
Simplicity is definitely a big asset on a trip like this, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what happens now, this trip that you did, the Alaska Yukon Expedition, that's a lot of miles and a lot of wilderness. Do you have to carry backups for some, like for your stove, I imagine repair parts, and, that must be a little bit of a challenge just to decide, well, how much backup do I need and what should it be, and, you know, what are my problems might my problems be?
Right. So figuring out what your needs are out there is definitely a big task. And I have this huge reservoir of trips and of past trips to kind of pull on or to look back at and inform those questions. So on the Alaska trip, I didn't really have a backup of anything. I had some sewing thread and a needle, and I had some duct tape and some glue, but there wasn't really anything in my pack that I was too concerned about sort of completely pooping out on me, so I wasn't worried about my backpack having a seam blow out or a shoulder strap pop rip, or I wasn't worried about my shelter tearing in two. I actually made my stove out of a 3 ounce cat food can, and I made it with the can, and then you take a hole punch and you punch some holes in the side of the can, and it burns denatured alcohol or heat, which is that bottle of yellow alcohol you can get at the gas station in the wintertime. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, there's no moving parts. There's nothing to break. It wouldn't clog up. So when I plan out my equipment, certainly trustworthiness is a big component of that.
Yeah. You have some techniques, I'm sure, that work for you? And I know one thing that it's a problem for everybody, whether they're, you know, it's winter, summer, whatever, is figuring out perfecting vapor barriers and sleep systems. Now, how does it work for you?
Yeah, that's, I've never been asked by a journalist about vapor barrier liners, but I'm assuming that you must be a user yourself, because most most people have no idea what they are. So a vapor barrier liner is it's a non-breathable layer, usually a piece of clothing or a liner inside of your sleeping bag that prevents moisture from your body from in the form of perspiration from moving out into your layers or your sleep system, and in really cold conditions, that moisture will hit the dew point as it's moving out towards the colder air, and it will go from water vapor to water, like actual moisture, water droplets, and that will soak the insulation. And if you do that for, you know, even 3 or 4 days, and or maybe a week or a week and a half, the warmth of your gear is greatly compromised. So a vapor barrier liner is a system to prevent that from happening. So I probably don't want to get too much into the details of the system that I use, but basically I have some sort of liner, so like a merino wool, say a merino wool pair of glove liners or merino wool base layer, and then I have the vapor barrier liner immediately on top of that, and then any outer layers outside of that.
Yeah, it's kind of important to keep dry out there, and because oftentimes, you know, there's no opportunity to remedy those situations. So
that's right. And one of my favorite stories from the wintertime, and I'm not sure if this is just urban legend or if this is true, but who's the gentleman up in Ely? Will Steger. When Will Steger did one of his Antarctic trips, he was trying out this new synthetic insulation. I think it was made by DuPont. I think it was like Qualifil or something. And by the end of the trip, he had something like 45 pounds of moisture frozen in his sleeping bag. And I'm sure he got paid quite a bit of money to use that insulation. I'm not sure he understood the limitations what the implications would be of not having a vapor barrier liner, but that's a tremendous amount of moisture that you have inside of your insulation. And, you know, it was probably wasn't the end of the world for him, because he had dog teams pulling his sleeping bag. But can you imagine if you had to carry a sleeping bag that had 45 pounds of moisture in it?
Yeah, or try to sleep at night with any warmth, you know, that all kind of disappears. And have you had, you know, you mentioned his experience, but have you had any really hairy moments out there? You know, you're out in the middle of the Alaska wilderness or the Yukon area, and stumble on a bear, or you sprain your ankle, or there's a lot of things that can happen. Anything that kind of either surprised you or set you back?
Yeah, well, I definitely had some close calls. I had one very exciting encounter with a grizzly bear up in Alaska, and had my fair share of cold and wet weather and sort of borderline hypothermia thing. But it's actually shocking that I haven't had fewer close encounters given the environment that I've been traveling through, you know, usually solo. And I think a lot of that has to do with the attitude that the greatest asset I have when I'm out there is not the stuff on my back, but the stuff that's between my ears. And when I'm out there, I make really good decisions, and I err on the side of caution, and I know my limits. And I think that that sort of being risk adverse like that is really what enables me to go on a trip like this and be successful with it, and not to have close calls day after day after day.
Well, Andrew, you're going to be appearing up here in the Northland rather soon. I believe it's May 7th. You're going to be the featured speaker at the Superior Hiking Trail Association annual meeting that's down at Wolf Ridge. And 7:30. Yeah, 7:30 p.m. I have a number of other things I'd like to hear from you, and I think maybe those topics can come up at that event. You're going to be speaking a lot about, I imagine, your systems anyway, and dietary needs, etc. But it's been great to have you on the Roadhouse here tonight. We're looking forward to when you do come up. Andrew Skirka, we've been speaking with. He's a distinguished adventurer. He's an athlete, a speaker. He's going to be speaking here, of course, guide and writer. Andrew, thanks so much for coming to join us here tonight.
Hey, thanks again for having me on. I'm looking forward to being up in Minnesota next weekend.
And we look forward to seeing you here.